Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
Back in the 1950s, when our family, along with over 1,000 other families, were housed in the new Dublin Corporation development of Finglas West, our homes were piped for gas from the Dublin Gas Company. Even better, in the company's Dalier Street showrooms, you could buy a cooker on the Never Never to cook the family meals. All that was needed was a little silver shilling, the coin with the bull on it, to slip into the gas meter. Then, with a twist of a wrist, a quiet ticking sound started as the meter measured out the shilling's worth of gas to the household. The system was not without its flaws. First, the meter was installed in the darkest, most awkward place in the entire house, under the stairs. Under the stairs was where we stored everything. Coats, hats, shoes, umbrellas, floor polish, footballs, hurleys. All the things which untidy the house were pegged in there where people could neither see them nor find them in a hurry. When the shilling's worth of gas had been consumed, it was then the task of somebody to wade into the darkness, tripping over the sweeping brush or the wellies, to insert another silver coin through a thin slit. The skill was to slip the shilling in with one deft movement while not letting it fall to the ground in the darkness. If it did fall, you listened for some hint that it had gone into a shoe or a boot and dreaded the distinctive note it gave when burying itself deep in the coal bucket. The person tasked with putting the shilling in the meter had to be a contortionist with the night vision of an owl. This was usually a middle child, as the eldest refused to do it and the youngest was too scared to do it. But the real problem with the system was that you first had to have a shilling coin before you could put it in. Hence my dread of the shout, "The gas is gone." Of course, it only ever seemed to happen in the middle of the dinner being made, or just before the milk for the morning cornflakes came to boil. And all through my childhood years, we never seemed to develop the knack of having a backup shilling on the shelf. So my mother would gather together a shilling in coins. You'd be praying it was 2 sixpenny bits and not 4 threepenny bits, and off you'd go, knocking on neighbours' doors with the well-learned line, "Mammy said, would you have a spare single shilling, please?" The thing was, we knew Mrs. Bryan would have one. Mrs. Bryan always had a spare single shilling. You walked up her pathway, knocked on her door and spouted out, "Mammy said, would you?" And before you had the sentence finished, she was off down the hall to return with the silver trophy and a smile. The problem was, you were not allowed to go directly to Mrs. Bryan. Mrs. Bryan had to be kept as a last resort, for fear anyone would think we were taking advantage of her. You had to first try your luck with at least 2 other neighbours. There was a little network of neighbours who looked after each other with a spare single shilling. They might or might not have one when you called, but if they had, they handed it over, regardless of whether you offered 2 sixpences or 4 threepences, and when they knocked on your door, you'd do the same willingly. The worst outcome of all was when you did the rounds of the network neighbours to no avail and then happily ran to Mrs. Bryan's door only to discover there was no one home. Disaster. On these occasions, there was nothing to be done except go outside the network and beg. You'd stroll up the path of the non-network neighbour, closing the gate behind you as an indication that you were the type of good child who would also close the gate on the way out. Then you knocked on the door. Not too hard, mind, not to be cheeky, just a pleasant little knock, which invariably they didn't hear because they were all sitting down watching your favourite programme on the telly. So you waited a suitable, mannerly amount of time before the second knock, which was just a tad louder. This continued until you finally had to give a right good bang on the knocker, only for the man of the house to come out saying, "What's all the banging about?" The truth is, I always hoped it would be the man of the house who opened the door. If he had a single shilling in his pocket, who would look you in the eye and hand it over. The mother and all the children knew the real value of the small coin with the big bull on it. But the man of the house, all he ever had to do was shout, "The gas is gone."
I ain't got nobody hanging around my doorstep. Ain't got no loose chain, just a hanging around my jeans. If you see somebody, would you send them over my way? I could use some help here with a can of pork and beans. I
once had a family. This morning I drove down Doncaster Avenue, and I slowed down outside number 27. There were no cars behind me, so I pushed in the clutch and stopped to look at the house. A red brick terrace house with bay windows looking on to a small concrete frontage and a path leading up to the front porch. Just the same, I thought. It's just the same as it was in 1979 when I came here to rent a room clogged with furniture for £7 a week. Inside that front door was a hall table, and on the hall table was a brass plate, and it's on that brass plate that I came home every Tuesday fortnight from work to find a letter from, well, let's call him James Conlon, who was in England at the time. Every second Tuesday, there it was, in response to the letter I had posted the previous Monday to him in Leeds. Our romance must have been sparked off the day that I and the music librarian visited library headquarters in Ballinahinch. From our own working premises in a small disused primary school situated at Tully West Crossroads near Saintfield in County Down. I met many people in library headquarters that day, but I was not introduced to him, though I did recognise him when he and some others paid a return visit to the music library as a tall man with a dark horseshoe moustache who had been loading books into cardboard boxes in the circulation department. I recall that we talked about music, both music he liked and music I liked, and that he told me he lived quite close by in Crossgar. And then, a few days later, while unpacking a delivery, I came across a green library index card addressed to me, with a red Fox's fruit suite attached to it by a length of sellotape. He was going away to do his master's in Leeds, he explained. At Halloween, a postcard arrived from Leeds with his address, and so our correspondence began. And a new quiet happiness came down on me. All that winter and into the spring, I looked forward to the Sundays I wrote to him almost more than the Tuesday evenings when I found his letter on the brass plate. Even posting my letter to him became a special act. I would take the letter in to work on the Monday and listen out for the postman's van coming into the yard. From time to time I would walk out to see if there were any sign of the red van on the roads. That part of County Down is all drumlins, round-shouldered hills, hunched and crowded, their narrow roads marked out with hawthorn that flickered into light in spring and in May, blazed with green. "Would you post a letter for me?" I always asked the postman with the unruly black hair and dark eyes, and he would take it from me and hand me the post for the library in return. I breathed easily again. The letter was safe. In the summer, he returned to his home in Crossgar. Two or three evenings a week, he would ride in from Crossgar to the farm to meet me coming out of work. We would walk all the way into Saintfield. In my memory, those walks were always in sunshine, with the sky blue. We walked along slowly, he wheeling the bike and guiding me round the outskirts of dried cowpats mixed with straw on the road. In Saintfield, we'd have a drink in the White Horse Inn, and then I would catch a bus into Belfast and he would cycle home. Once I missed the bus, and we walked all the way to Crossgar to meet the next one. Once we climbed Slieve Donard, and he asked me if I loved him. I don't know, I said. Would you have 7 wee boys by me? He asked. Yes, I said. Does that mean yes? Yes, he said. Carol looks very happy, my father remarked to my mother. When did the change begin? When did his heart start to colden towards me? Where was the first sign? Was it the day he arrived in Tully West with a friend, so that all along my enchanted road I felt like a hanger-on? Or was it the night of that concert at Queen's, when he got up at the interval to get a drink and spent 30 minutes in the company of friends he knew were in the bar? Just before Christmas, he phoned to say he was going to London to look for work. But I'll ring you next week, he said. I'll write letters to you next week. But next week the brass plate on the hall table was bare, and again the next week bare, and again and again and again bare, and the sight of that bare brass plate bore into me and followed me daily up the stairs to my empty, cluttered room. No letter ever came. I would never hear from him again. Anguish, I thought, seeing a car come up behind me in the rear-view mirror and letting out the clutch. Anguish is an empty brass plate on a hall table in a house on Doncaster Avenue.
The grounding of a ghost ship on the Cork coastline during Storm Dennis in February raised many eyebrows and prompted a flood of questions. The vessel was the cargo ship Alta, abandoned in the mid-Atlantic in 2018 when 10 crew members were rescued from the ship by the American Coast Guard. Floating freely since, the vessel drifted onto the rocks at Ballycotton, apparently out of the blue. Crewless drifting ships are found throughout maritime history, and the description of such vessels as ghost ships provokes mysterious and colourful stories. Perhaps the most famous of these is the fictitious Flying Dutchman, which appears to have originated in the 17th century. The Dutchman was a ship of the damned, destined to sail the ocean waves for eternity, never reaching port. It has inspired many works of art, including an opera by Richard Wagner, multiple popular music recordings, and has regularly featured in literature, including Coleridge's The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. Movies have used it as a storyline too, one of the most recent being the Pirates of the Caribbean series, although if I had a favourite, it would probably be The Goonies from the mid-1980s. Based on a story by Steven Spielberg. This waves all the classic elements of the ghost ship narrative into one gripping yarn. A treasure map, a dangerous quest, the discovery of a lost ship full of gold and crewed by skeletal sailors, and a satisfying conclusion. Here the ghost ship sails away into the sunset, commanded by the ghostly captain, One-Eyed Willie. In real life, there have been numerous findings of abandoned yachts, which may have broken away from moorings or been damaged or abandoned during storms. Some have even been found with the mummified remains of their captains aboard. The Japanese Coast Guard regularly finds ghost vessels, many of which are fishing boats thought to have originated in North Korea. Nearer to home in 2013, a scrapped Soviet cruise ship was reported to be drifting close to the Irish coast. The Lyubov Orlova was being towed from St. John's, Newfoundland, to a scrapyard in the Caribbean when the towing cable snapped, setting her adrift in international waters. The ship was later reported off the Irish coast, some news reports claiming that it was infested with cannibal rats. The fate of the ship is unknown, but the last contact Irish authorities had with the vessel was from an automated emergency signal, suggesting the ship had sunk. In the long history of ghost ships, my own county of Waterford has had its share too. One of the most notorious must be the sailing ship Earl of Sandwich, which was found partially submerged and crewless on the Waterford coast in 1776. The ship was on a voyage from the Canary Islands to London with an 8-man crew with 4 passengers. The main passenger was a Captain Glass, who had in his possession a treasure of gold, jewels and Spanish silver dollars. 4 of the crew became aware of the hoard and plotted to rob it. In sight of the Waterford coast, the conspirators acted. They murdered Captain Glass, his wife and young daughter, and his servant, and their 4 remaining crew members, and threw them all overboard. Their final act before rowing away with their haul in the ship's boat was to scuttle the vessel in an attempt to hide any evidence of their bloody deed. But the Earl of Sandwich didn't sink, and the suspicions of the authorities were aroused. Following a widespread search, the 4 sailors were tracked to New Ross and eventually apprehended on the road to Dublin. They were tried and found guilty of murder. Hoping for leniency, they had given up the whereabouts of the stolen treasure, which was buried in a secluded cove on the Hook Peninsula, ever since known as Dollar Bay. The crime was deemed so serious, however, they were hanged and their corpses suspended in metal cages around Dublin Port, serving as a gruesome warning to other sailors. There remains a perplexing list of ghost ship mysteries. Arguably, the most enduring is the Mary Celeste, which was found floating off the Azores in the Atlantic in 1872. There was no sign of the 10-man crew, who left behind their possessions, a full cargo, and a 6-month supply of food. Despite an inquiry, no plausible explanation could be found. The Alta won't be joining that list of mysteries. Since February, any potential environmental hazards have been removed from the vessel, and the fear now is that it will be left to break up in subsequent storms as its ownership, and therefore responsibility for its removal, is still in question. The only remaining puzzle is how it arrived without warning onto the Irish coastline. But even if the grounding of the ship lacks much of the intrigue of the ghost ships of the past, it is still a welcome reminder of the many murky mysteries of the sea.
Better far to live and die under the brave black flag I fly than play a sanctimonious part with a pirate head and a pirate heart. Away to the cheating world go you, where pirates all are well to do, but I'll be true to the song I sing and live and die.
On Fridays, we climb into my sister Elaine's Renault 4 and make our way out the roads to the embankment in Talla, with the Connolly sisters, Trish and Mags, and sometimes Celia Murphy. Eamon Welsh, who danced like John Travolta, and a ballroom dancer called Sally. All of us squashed in, sitting on each other's knees, with feathers, top hats, canes, and black and silver lurex material that we swathed around us Grecian style for the slower numbers. The cabaret lounge filled up. Groups and couples sitting around tables, and each table had an orange lamp so the punters could see their drinks and later chicken and chips. Mick McCarthy, the owner of the embankment and MC, introduced us. Ladies and gentlemen, these dancers are not only the best in Dublin, not only the best in Ireland, not only the best in Europe, but the best dancers you'll see anywhere in the world. We cringed. wishing that we could cartwheel and backflip onto the floor to live up to his words. But on came the first bars of In the Mood, and we clattered out, flat tap shoes, boned leotard, fishnet tights, top hats and canes. "You've got to do the tap numbers, otherwise they won't know that you're real dancers," my mother Laurie insisted. "You can also do something from Hello Dolly." "Oh God, no way." But my mother was a dancer, and we grew up learning to walk and dance in an instinctual way, so used to obeying her dance instructions that we just went along with it. I don't know how she got us those gigs, because mostly we appeared with traditional musicians like Paddy Casey, Clannad and the Furies, waiting quietly every night to hear Davy Arthur playing The Lonesome Boatman on his tin whistle before clambering back into the Renault 4. "Here now," Mick McCarthy said when we were having a drink after the show. "There's a fiver for anyone who can do this batter." And there he was, loose-limbed, his feet beating out a complicated little set of Shannos taps on the scratched wooden floor. My mother got right up and mimicked him step by step, so that he had to hand over the fiver. "Who are they?" Red Hurley whispered. "The Nolans?" To our further embarrassment, photographs of the four of us, the Connolly sisters and my sister Elaine and me, appeared in the newspaper under the headline, "Long Legs Up in the Embankment." We got another gig in the Fox's Covert, and for this we made up, our word for choreographed, a kind of ballet. Elaine and Trish Connolly went into town to look for costumes and came back with four peach nightdresses from Dunn's. They were flowing and lovely, they said, and we agreed, lovely. On the third week, you couldn't get into the venue with the crowds. "Couples only," the bouncer said to my fella. "But I'm with one of the dancers. In your dreams, boy." Obviously, my mother was way ahead of the X Factor when she announced the 20-week talent show in the Rathfarnham Inn, with the four of us singing and dancing in the intervals, or dancing behind the guest artist crooning Blue Bio. She was in full flight as MC. "Ladies and gentlemen, on the last night, the final will be judged by RTE personalities." This was worrying, because I knew for a fact that she hadn't been talking to anyone from RTE. Cooped up night after night in the dressing room, a row about creative differences broke out between the Connollys and me and Elaine. My mother came through the door. "My God, you can be heard downstairs by the audience." But the row released a new spurt of creativity, and Mags Connolly and my sister Elaine spent hours working on a new dance, designing costumes and telling us to wait and see. Just before the final, I heard my mother on the phone to someone in RTE. "I've been let down very badly." "Yes, no judges. If you can do anything, anything at all." Then, "Oh, thanks, that's great. You are an angel." And so it was that on the final night, the intrepid Brendan Balf and Michael Murphy, the newsreader, were sitting up front and trying not to laugh as Trish Connolly, wrapped from head to toe in tinfoil, jerked her way across the stage to "I Am Your Automatic Lover." But we all agreed that the winner of the talent show that night, with her wild red hair and sequin dress, was a worthy one. As she belted out, "Go on now, go, walk out the door." And every woman and man who'd ever been cheated on, or even just ever felt a little undervalued, stood up and cheered.
Another time. Most mornings, the good doctor swims in the little sandy harbour, alongside seals rolling in the tide, and a shoal of whitebait switching this way and that. Land-based, coast-conscious, on rocks that only go out so far, the Zen-like cormorant dries its wings like a hooker's sails, hardly moving despite all the fuss. as we approach, dog-tied and running repairs here and there. The houses seem to be watching. Words bubble in the mind from first things, early promptings. What was I thinking about? Another time, the start of a poem, one of those that stray off into the sounds of car horn and ambulance siren. The street sweeper's rapid machine, the heavy baffling engines of the Boston flight as it breaks sky cover above Hook Head.
In the summer of 1972, Alice Cooper's hit School's Out captured my mood. With the A-levels over, I was heading off to Scotland to work in a fruit canning factory. After 18 years on a small farm in rural Fermanagh, Scotland was as exotic to me then as Timbuktu. I bought a trendy duffel bag into which I packed my treasured new hot pants, my purple velvet smock, my white tights and my checked Oxford bags. It was a beautiful day when I met my school friend Margaret in Enniskillen to hitchhike to Belfast. And with my duffel bag on my back, I felt myself on the edge of a world of boundless possibilities. With lorry drivers as our knights in shining armour, we made good time. Our ferry was due to sail at midnight. Our plan was to spend the day checking out the clothes shops in the city centre. It was not to be. In Belfast, our lorry driver was forced to stop at the top of the Donegal Road. At a checkpoint, young soldiers shouted at us to keep our heads down as someone was shooting at them. Terrified, we crouched down and the driver swung into Sandy Row. But there, a tartan gang carrying clubs headed towards us. The driver, with an air of calm resignation, told us it was his lorry they wanted and we would be okay. The same soldiers came to his rescue, but they ordered us out so they could search our bags. They looked no older than us, and when they got a look at us with our flowery bags off on our big adventure, they chatted and joked with us instead of doing a bag search. Our shopping plans were back on target, or so we thought, before we walked unsuspectingly into one of the most horrific days of the Troubles Belfast would ever experience. At least 19 IRA bombs exploded in the city centre in an 80-minute period. 9 people would die and 130 would be injured. In the letter I wrote to my mother from Scotland 2 days later, I describe my experience. Honestly, I write, it was really awful. Ambulances and fire brigades screeching, explosions going off and people running everywhere, some with blood streaming down their face. Someone would tell us to run as it was dangerous where we were. So off we would go. We would meet people rushing in the opposite direction and they would shout at us not to go that way. Then we would run another way and be turned back from there. We didn't know what to do. There were explosions all over the place and rubble everywhere. I did not say in my letter how I saw my own terror reflected in the eyes of all those running in fear for their lives and how I would have given anything then to be back in the home I had been so anxious to leave. Somehow we made our way to the docks. But we weren't allowed into the ferry terminus. Exhausted and out of options, we sat on the pavement. Soldiers suddenly surrounded us. I asked one if we were safe where we were. His not very reassuring reply was that we would be if the next bomb was less than 20 pounds. Where to go? Margaret found the crumpled phone number of a 17-year-old boy called Barney, whom she'd met in Bundoran. We found a phone box and rang him. Miraculously, he arrived and brought us in a black taxi to his home in Andersonstown. After his mammy fed us tea and homemade apple tart, we returned to the docks to see the twisted metal of a 50-pound bomb which had destroyed the Liverpool bar, strewn over the same pavement where we had been sitting. I only made that contact with home by letter when we eventually got to the factory in Scotland, as my parents hadn't a telephone. I didn't know that until they got my letter they were frantic with worry, having seen on television the shocking images of mutilated bodies being swept up and collected in black plastic bags. The impact of the bombs was so horrific that for several days it was believed that the death toll was much higher than 9. My parents had no way of knowing if I was among them. My mother kept my letter, and I have it now. There is something unusual about it. She always opened letters carefully with a paper knife, but this envelope is roughly torn open. With its jagged, uneven edges comes a whole new realization of their relief when the letter arrived. Today, I remember the victims of that day, known as Bloody Friday, and the families for whom no letter arrived.
On this morning's Sunday Miscellany, we heard The Spare Single Shilling by Brian Farrell. Carl Nicholas brought us a brass plate. Ghost Ships was from Andrew Doherty. Long Legs Up in the Embankment was from Lanny O'Hanlon. Gerald Doerr read the poem Another Time, and Bloody Friday there was brought to us by Olive Travers. The music you heard this morning included Knocking on Your Screen Door by John Prine. Then we had The Johnstons with Hey, That's No Way to Say Goodbye. The King Singers gave us The Pirate King from The Pirates of Penzance. I Will Survive was, of course, Gloria Gaynor. And Impromptu in E Major by Clara Schumann was played by Yosef Thimbenhauer. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey and the producer is Sarah Binchy. For more from this and other RTE culture programmes, you can see rte.ie/culture.
RTE Radio 1.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.